she was shivering in a desolate courtyard with the other woman prisoners. It was late afternoon, already dark, and there was snow on the ground. In front of Grace was a depressing gray stone building. Behind her, and to the left and right, were row after row of barbed-wired fences jutting violently into the purple night sky. Grace was ashamed to find herself crying.
"Welcome to Bedford Hills, ladies. Enjoy your stay."
It was 3 hours before Grace reached the cell she was to share with two other women. By that time, she knew she would not survive a week at Bedford Hills, never mind the rest of her life.
"I have to get out of here. I have to reach John Merrivale. John will get me out."
The physical examination was the worst part. A brutal, degrading experience. It was designed to strip prisoners of all human dignity. It worked. Grace was forced to strip naked in a room full of people. A prison doctor inserted a speculum into her vagina and took a pap smear. Next, Grace was made to bend over while a latex-gloved finger probed her anus, presumably for hidden drugs. Her pubic hairs were pulled painfully in search of lice. Throughout the procedure, prison guards of both sexes laughed and made disgusting, lewd comments. Grace felt as if she had been raped. After that, she was herded like an animal into a tepid shower and told to wash with antiseptic soap that burned her skin. Next, still naked, she stood in line to have her long hair cropped boy short. The haircut took all of 15 seconds, but it was a harrowing procedure, robbing Grace of her femininity, her entire identity as a woman. Grace never saw her own clothes again. They were gone, along with every other vestige of the person she had been on the outside. They even took her wedding ring, wrenching it painfully off her finger. In place of her old clothes, Grace was given 3 pairs of underwear, a bra that didn't fit, and a scratchy orange prison uniform 2 sizes too big for her.
"In here!"
A stocky female prison guard opened the door of a cell and pushed Grace inside. 2 Latina women lay on bunks in the grim 12-by-9-foot box. They muttered something to each other in Spanish as Grace staggered in, but otherwise ignored her. Screwing up her courage, Grace turned to the guard.
"There's been a mistake. I'd like to see the warden, please. I believe I've been transferred to the wrong facility."
"Is that so?"
"Yes. This is a maximum security prison. I was convicted of fraud, not murder. I don't belong here."
The Latina woman's eyes widened. But if the guard was shocked, she didn't show it.
"You can see the warden in the morning. Now you sleep."
The cell door closed. Grace lay back on her bunk. She couldn't sleep. Her mind was racing.
"In the morning, I'll see the warden. I'll be transferred to a better prison. That's the first step. Then I can call John Merrivale and start my appeal."
She should have called John in the first place. She didn't know what stupid, childish impulse had made her turn to honor instead. It was a hard thing to admit that she couldn't trust her own family, but that was the reality. Grace had to face it.
"Lenny looked on John as a brother. John's my family now. He's all I've got."
Clearly, hiring Frank Hammond had been a titanic mistake. But Grace couldn't blame John for that. The point now was to move forward.
"Tomorrow. Things will be better tomorrow."
Frank Hammond sat alone in his car in a deserted parking lot. He watched the familiar figure of his client making his way toward him through the shadows. Every few seconds, the man glanced over his shoulder nervously, afraid he was being watched. Big Frank thought,
He looks so pathetic,
so weak, like a deer caught in the headlights.
No one would suspect a man like that of doing something this audacious. I suppose that's how he got away with it.
The man got into the car and thrust a piece of paper into Frank Hammond's hands.
What's this?
It's a receipt. The wire transfer went through an hour ago.
To my offshore account?
Of course, just as we agreed.
Thank you.
$25 million. It was a lot of money, but was it enough? After he'd publicly screwed up Grace Brookstein's defense, Frank Hammond's reputation was in tatters. He might never get hired again. Still, it was too late for regrets.
I trust you are happy with the job?
His client smiled.
Very happy. She trusted you completely. Then our business is concluded.
Frank Hammond started the engine. His client put a hand on his arm.
There are no grounds for appeal, are there?
None whatsoever.
Unless, of course, the FBI happens to find that missing money. But that's not going to happen, is it, John?
No, it isn't. Not in this lifetime.
John Merrivel allowed himself a small smile. Then he got out of the car and quietly disappeared back into the shadows.
Warden James McIntosh was intrigued. Like everybody else in the country, he knew who Grace Brookstein was. She was the woman who helped her husband embezzle billions of dollars, then inexplicably shown up for her trial channeling Marie Antoinette, alienating the vengeance-crazed American public even further. Warden McIntosh was a tired, disillusioned man in his early 50s, with balding gray hair and a matching thin mustache. He was intelligent and not without compassion, although Grace Brookstein did little to inspire it. Most of the women who wound up at Bedford Hills had had lives straight out of a Dickens novel. Raped by their fathers, beaten by their husbands, forced into prostitution and drugs while still in their teens, many of them never stood a chance at living normal, civilized lives. Grace Brookstein was different. Grace Brookstein had had it all, but she'd still wanted more. Warden McIntosh had no time for that sort of naked greed. James Ian McIntosh joined the prison service because he genuinely believed that he could do good, that he could make a difference. What a joke. After 8 years at Bedford Hills, his aims had grown more modest, to make it to retirement with his sanity and his pension intact. James McIntosh did not want Grace Brookstein at Bedford Hills. He'd argued with his superiors about it.
Come on, Bill, give me a break. She's white collar, plus she's a walking incitement to riot. Half of my prisoners have family members who lost their jobs after quorum collapsed, and the other half hate her for being rich and white and wearing that goddamn mink coat to trial.
But it was no use.
It was because Grace was so hated that she was being sent to Bedford Hills. Nowhere else would she be protected. Now, less than one full day into her sentence, she was already stirring up trouble, demanding to see him as if this was some sort of hotel and he were the manager.
What's the problem, Mrs. Brookstein? Sheets not soft for you? Complimentary champagne not quite chilled?
He gestured for Grace to sit down.
You asked to see me?
Yes.
Grace exhaled, forcing the stress out of her body. It was nice to be sitting in an office
talking to an educated, civilized man. The warden had family photographs on his desk. It felt like a tiny, much-needed dose of reality.
"Thank you for seeing me, Warden McIntosh. There seems to have been a mistake."
The warden raised an eyebrow. "Does there?"
"Well, yes. You see, this is a maximum security facility."
"Is it? I hadn't noticed." Grace swallowed. She felt nervous all of a sudden. Was he laughing with her or at her?
"This is my chance to explain. I mustn't screw it up." "My crime, the crime that I was convicted of, it wasn't violent," she began. "I mean, I'm innocent, Warden. I didn't actually do what they said I did. But that's not why I'm here."
Warden McIntosh thought, "Thank heaven for small mercies." If he had a dollar for every inmate who sat in front of him protesting her innocence, he'd have retired to Malibu Beach years ago. Grace was still talking.
"The thing is, even if I had done it, I don't think... What I'm trying to say is, I don't belong here."
"I couldn't agree more." Grace's heart soared.
"Thank God. He's a reasonable man. He'll sort this mess out, move me out of this cattle farm."
"Unfortunately, my superiors feel differently.
You see, they feel that it's the state's responsibility to see to it that you aren't lynched. They're concerned your fellow inmates might want to, beat you to death with a crowbar or strangle you with bedsheets, pour acid on your face while you sleep, perhaps. Something of that nature."
Grace went white. She felt her insides liquefy with fear. Warden McIntosh went on.
"For some reason, my bosses believe you're less likely to come to physical harm at Bedford than anywhere else. A misperception, in my opinion. But tell me, Grace, what do you suggest we do about it?"
Grace couldn't speak.
"Perhaps if some harm actually did come to you here, they'd reconsider their decision? Do you think that's possible?"
Warden McIntosh looked Grace in the eye. That's when she knew for sure.
"They're going to try to kill me. And he doesn't give a damn. He hates me as much as the rest of them."
"I'm moving you to a different wing. You'll have to let me know whether your new cell is more to your liking. Now, if you'll excuse me..."
The guard led Grace away. Grace's new cellmates were a 200-pound black cocaine dealer named Cora Buds and a slim, pretty brunette in her early 30s. The brunette's name was Karen Willis. The guard told Grace that Karen had shot and killed her sister's boyfriend.
"They both got life. Like you. You'll have plenty of time to get to know each other."
He smiled knowingly. Grace wondered if he was making a sexual innuendo, but was too frightened to ask.
"I mustn't fight shadows. I'm sure it's a myth that all women prisoners are lesbians."
Grace eyed Karen and Cora warily, climbing onto her bunk in silence.
"Warden McIntosh sent me here as a punishment. These women may be violent. They may try to hurt me. I have to stay on my guard."
Cora Buds heaved her great bulk off her own bunk and sat down next to Grace.
"What's your name, honey?"
She stank of bad breath and sweat. Grace instinctively recoiled.
Grace. My name's Grace.
For some reason, Cora Budd seemed to find this amusing.
Grace! Amazing Grace! She cackled. What are you in for, Amazing Grace?
Fraud,
Grace whispered. It still felt strange and embarrassing saying the word.
But it's a mistake. I'm innocent.
Cora laughed even harder.
Fraud, huh? You hear that, Karen? We got us an innocent con artist. We coming up in the world.
Suddenly, the smile died on Cora's lips.
Hey, wait a minute. What'd you say your name was again?
Grace?
Grace who?
For a minute, Grace hesitated.
Grace who?
It was a good question. This whole situation was so unreal, it was as if her identity had already slipped away from her. Who am I? I don't know anymore. At last she said,
Brookstein. My name is Grace Brookstein.
Grace didn't even have time to flinch. Cora's fist slammed into her face so hard she heard her nose crack.
Bitch!
Cora yelled. She hit Grace again. Blood gushed everywhere. Karen Willis continued reading her book as if nothing had happened.
You the bitch that stole all that money?
No,
Grace spluttered.
I didn't.
My brother lost his job because of you. All them old folks out on the streets while you and your old man were eating caviar. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. I'm gonna make you wish you was never born, Grace Brookstein.
Grace clutched at her nose. Whimpering, she said,
Please, I didn't steal any money.
Cora Buds grabbed her by her orange prison shirt and yanked her to her feet. With one hand, she slammed Grace's back against the wall, lifting her as easily as she would a rag doll.
Don't you speak! Don't you fucking speak to me, you rich white bitch!
With each word, Cora banged Grace's skull against the wall, driving her point home. Warm blood seeped into Grace's newly short hair. She began to lose consciousness. Karen Willis said in a bored voice,
Cool it, Cora. Denny'll hear ya.
You think I give a fuck?
Sure enough, a few seconds later, the cell door opened. Hannah Denzel, known to the inmates as Denny, among other things, was the most senior guard in A-Wing. A short, dumpy white woman, with beetle brows and an incipient mustache, she reveled in her authority and enjoyed making the prisoners' lives as miserable and degrading as possible. She surveyed the scene in front of her. Grace Brookstein lay slumped on the floor in a pool of blood. Cora Buds stood over her like King Kong with Fay Wray, only without the ape's tenderness. Grace was conscious but barely, mumbling something incoherent. Denny said,
I want this mess cleaned up.
Cora Buds shrugged.
Tell her! It ain't my blood!
Fine. She can do it, but make sure she does. I'll be back in an hour. That night, Grace lay awake, rigid with fear, waiting for Cora Buds to fall asleep. Earlier, she had mopped up her own blood, sluicing the floor on her hands and knees while Cora watched and Karen read her book. After an hour, Denny returned, nodded a curt approval, and left Grace to her fate. Grace cowered on her bunk, waiting for Cora to launch another attack, but nothing happened. In a way, she wished it would. Nothing was worse than waiting, the gut-twisting terror of anticipation. Finally, 20 minutes before lights out, the cell door opened and Grace was summoned to the prison doctor. After a perfunctory clean-up, she was given 6 stitches for the gash to her head and an ineffectual band-aid to help set her broken nose, then sent right back to Cora. Grace pulled the blankets tightly around her.
It had been a long time since she'd prayed, but she closed her eyes tight and opened her heart to the heavens. "Help me. God, please help me. I'm surrounded by enemies. It's not just Cora. They all hate me. The other prisoners, the guards, Warden McIntosh, those people outside the courthouse. Even my own family has deserted me. I don't ask for myself, Lord. I don't care what happens to me anymore. But if I die, who will clear Lenny's name? Who will uncover the truth?" Grace tried to make sense of it all. But every time she found a piece of the puzzle, the other pieces drifted away from her. Frank Hammond's voice. "Someone framed Lenny." But who? And why? Why did Lenny make me a partner in Quorum and cut John out? Where are the Quorum billions now? The pain Cora's fist had inflicted was nothing compared with the pain of Grace's inner anguish. Being here, in this awful place, felt like a bad dream. But it wasn't. It was reality. Maybe it was my life before that was the dream. Me and Lenny, our happiness, our friends, our life. Was it all a mirage? Was it all built on lies? That was the greatest irony of all. Here Grace was, branded a fraud and a liar. But it wasn't Grace who had lied. It was everyone else, her sisters, her friends, all the people who had eaten at her and Lenny's table, who had slapped them on the back during the good times, holding out their hands, vying with one another to pay homage to the king. Their affection, their loyalty, that was the lie. Where were those people now? Gone. All of them. Scattered on the wind, vanished into thin air like the missing Quorum billions. All except for John Merrivale. Dear John. Grace woke up screaming. Karen Willis clamped a hand over her mouth. "Shh! You'll wake Cora!" Grace was shaking. Her bedsheets were drenched with sweat. She'd been having a nightmare. It started off as a beautiful dream. She was walking down the aisle on Nantucket, on Michael Gray's arm. Lenny was waiting at the altar with his back to her. John Merrivale was there, smiling, nervous. There were white roses everywhere. The choir was singing Panis Angelicus. As Grace got closer to the altar, she became aware of a strange smell. Something chemical, like formaldehyde. Lenny turned around. Suddenly, his face began to collapse, melting like a doll's head in an oven. His torso started to swell till it burst through his shirt, the skin ghostly white and goosebumped. Then, limb by limb, the hideous corpse fell to pieces. Grace opened her mouth to scream, but it was full of water. Great waves of seawater had flooded the church, sweeping away the wedding guests, destroying everything in their path, flowing into Grace's lungs, choking her. She was drowning. She couldn't breathe. "You'll wake Cora!" It took a couple of seconds for Grace to register that Karen was real. "She gets mad when her sleep is disturbed. You wouldn't like Cora when she's mad." After what happened earlier, Karen's statement was so ridiculous, Grace laughed. Then the laugh turned into a cry. Soon, Grace was sobbing in Karen's arms, all the loss and terror and pain of the last 6 months flooding out of her body like pus from a lanced boil. Finally, Grace asked, "Why didn't you do something this afternoon?"
"Do something? About what?"
"About the attack. When Cora tried to kill me..."
"Honey, that was nothing. If Cora tried to kill you, you'd be dead."
"But you didn't even move. You just sat there and let her assault me." Karen sighed.
"Let me ask you something, Grace.
Do you want to survive in here?
Grace thought about it. She wasn't sure. In the end, she nodded. She had to survive for Lenny.
In that case, you better get one thing straight. Ain't no one gonna rescue you. Not me. Not the guards. Not your appeal lawyer. Not your mama. No one. You are alone here, Grace. You gotta learn to rely on yourself.
Grace remembered her phone call to Honor.
When are you gonna start taking responsibility? You are not Daddy's little princess anymore. You can't expect me and Connie to fix everything.
Then she remembered Lenny.
I'll take care of you, Grace. You'll never have to worry about anything again.
The advice is free, said Karen, creeping back to her own bunk. But when you remember where you hid all that money, maybe you can send me a little token of your appreciation.
Grace was about to protest her innocence again, but changed her mind. What was the point? If her own family didn't believe her, why on earth would anybody else?
Sure, Karen. I'll do that.
Grace took her cellmate's advice. For the next 2 weeks, she kept her head down, her wits about her and her thoughts and fears to herself.
No one's going to help me. I'm on my own. I have to figure out how life here works.
Grace learned that Bedford Hills was admired across the country as a model for its progressive outreach programs aimed at helping incarcerated mothers. Of the 850 inmates, more than 70% were mothers in their 30s. Grace was astonished to learn that Cora Buds was one of them.
Cora's a mom?
Why do you look so shocked? Said Karen. Cora's got 3 kids. Her youngest, Anna May, was born right here. Baby came 2 weeks early. Sister Bernadette delivered her on the floor of the prenatal center.
Grace had read an article once about babies being born in prison, or she had heard something on NPR. Either way, she remembered feeling appalled for the children of these selfish, criminal mothers. But that was in another life, another time. In this life, Grace did not find the Children's Center at Bedford Hills remotely appalling. On the contrary, staffed by inmates and local Roman Catholic nuns, it was the one bright spot of hope in the otherwise unremittingly grim regime of the prison. Grace would have dearly loved to get a job there, but there was no chance. Karen told her,
"New blood always gets the worst jobs."
Grace was put to work in the fields.
The work itself was backbreaking. Chopping wood to build the new chicken coops, clearing swathes of weed-covered ground to make way for the bird runs. But it was the hours that really killed Grace. The Bedford Hills day bore no relation to light and darkness or to the rhythms of the outside world. After lights out at 10:30 p.m., prisoners got only 4 hours of unbroken sleep, before low lighting came on again at 2:30 a.m. This was so that the field workers could eat breakfast and be outside in the bitter cold working by 4. Lunch was served in the communal mess hall at 9:30. Dinner was at 2, 8.5 long, boring hours before lights out. Grace felt like she was permanently jet-lagged, exhausted but unable to sleep.
"You'll get used to it," said Karen.
Grace wasn't so sure. The worst part of all was the loneliness. Often, Grace would go entire days without speaking to a single soul other than Karen. Other prisoners had friendships. Grace watched the women she worked with lean on one another for support. During breaks, they would talk about their kids or their husbands or their appeals. But nobody spoke to Grace.
"You're an outsider," Karen told her.
You're not one of us. Plus, you know, they figure you and your old man stole from people like us. So, there's a lot of anger.
It'll pass. But you're not angry, Grace observed.
Karen shrugged.
I used up all my anger a ways back.
Besides, who knows? Maybe you really are innocent. No offense, but you don't come across as no criminal mastermind to me.
Grace's eyes welled with tears of gratitude. She believes me. Someone believes me.
She clung to Karen's words like a life raft. Brookstein, you got a visitor.
Me?
Grace was coming in from the chicken runs. It was 2 days after Christmas, and a heavy snow had fallen overnight. Grace's hands were red raw with cold, and her breath plumed in front of her like steam from a boiling kettle.
I don't see no other Brookstein. Visiting hour's almost over, so you better get your ass inside now, or you'll miss her.
Her?
Grace wondered who it could be. Honor or Connie, perhaps? They've realized they were too tough on me. They're going to help me file an appeal. The guard led her into the visitor's room. There, sitting at a small wooden table, was Caroline Merrivale. In an oversized fox fur coat, her fingers glittering with diamonds like Cruella de Vil, she looked uncomfortable and laughably out of place in the dismal box of a room, a visitor from another world. Grace sat down opposite her.
Caroline, this is a surprise.
During the trial, when she had stayed with the Merrivales, Grace had sensed a growing hostility in Caroline. John, darling John, had been staunch in his support from first to last. But Caroline, whom Grace had once thought of as such a dear friend, almost as a surrogate mother, had been aloof, even cruel at times, as if she were enjoying Grace's suffering. She had not bothered to hide her irritation about the unwelcome press attention Grace's presence in the house attracted.
It's intolerable, like living in a cage at the zoo. When is all this going to end?
The deference she had once shown Grace as Lenny's wife had been replaced by a haughty coolness. Grace tried not to resent it. After all, if it weren't for Caroline and John, she'd have been out on the streets. She wouldn't have had the great Frank Hammond to defend her. She wouldn't have had a thing. But Caroline's bitterness still stung. She was the last person Grace expected to see at Bedford Hills. Caroline looked around, like a nervous flyer searching for the nearest emergency exit.
I can't stay long.
That's okay. It was good of you to come at all. Did John get my letter?
Grace had written to John a week ago, asking him about the next steps. What should she do about an appeal? Should she hire a new attorney? How long did he think it would be before they agreed to review her case, etc.? He had yet to reply.
He did. Yes.
Silence.
He's been very busy, Grace. The FBI is still looking for the missing money. John's been helping them as best he can.
Grace nodded meekly.
Of course, I understand.
She waited for Caroline to say something else, to ask her how she'd been holding up, perhaps, or if she needed anything. But she didn't. Desperate to prolong the encounter, her first with the outside world in weeks, Grace started babbling.
It's not too bad in here. I mean, of course it's bad, but you try and get used to it. The worst thing is how tiring the days are. It makes it hard to focus on anything. I keep thinking about Lenny, about how any of this could have happened. I mean, someone framed us. That much is obvious, but after that it all gets so tangled. Hopefully once John starts my appeal, there'll be some light at the end of the tunnel. But at the moment, it's just so dark. I feel lost.
Grace, there won't be any appeal.
Grace blinked, like a mole into the sunlight.
I'm sorry?
Caroline's voice grew harsh.
I said there won't be an appeal, at least not with our help or our money. Look, John stuck with you for as long as he could, but he's had to face the truth now. We all have.
The truth? What do you mean? What truth?
Grace was shaking.
You can stop with the little girl lost act, Caroline spat.
It won't wash with me. Lenny ripped off his investors and his partners. He betrayed poor John. You both did.
That's not true. Caroline, you must believe me. I know Lenny changed the partnership structure, and it's true I don't know why, but I know he would never have done anything to hurt John intentionally.
Oh, come on, Grace. How stupid do you think people are? Why don't you come clean and tell the FBI where the money is? This was a nightmare. A sick joke.
I don't know where the money is. John knows that. John believes me.
No, Caroline said brutally. He doesn't. Not anymore. He wants nothing more to do with you. I came here today to ask you to stop contacting him. After everything you and Lenny have done to him, to all of us, you owe us that much at least. She stood up to leave. Grace fought down the urge to throw herself into her arms and plead for mercy. Inside, her throat was hoarse from screaming.
Don't leave me, please. Don't take John away from me. He's my only hope.
Outwardly, she kept her mouth clamped shut, afraid that if she opened it, the screams would never stop. Here. Caroline pressed a small, tissue-wrapped package into Grace's hand while the guard's back was turned. John wanted me to give you this. Weak, sentimental fool that he is. I told him you're hardly likely to get much wear out of it rotting your life away in here. She laughed cruelly.
But given that it's hideous and of no earthly use to me, I suppose you may as well take it.
She turned on her heel and was gone. Numbly, Grace followed the guard back to her cell. She'd slipped the package inside her sleeve and kept it hidden until she was safely back on her bunk. Her hands trembled as she opened it, carefully unfolding the tissue paper. John Merrivale had been Grace's last true friend. My only friend. Whatever this package contained, he had wanted her to have it. It was a brooch. A butterfly brooch in rainbow-colored glass. Grace's eyes welled up with tears. Lenny had bought it for her last Christmas from a second-hand store in Key West. When the police froze Coram's assets, they'd seized all of Lenny's personal effects, including Grace's jewelry. The brooch must have slipped through the net, perhaps because it was valueless, but it could not have been worth more to Grace if it had been made of solid diamonds. It was a last piece of Lenny, a last symbol of happiness, of hope, of everything that she had lost forever. It was her passport to freedom, eternal freedom. Gently, lovingly, Grace released the brooch's pin from its clasp and started slashing her wrists. Chapter 11. She was surrounded by brilliant white light. Not the peaceful kind. The blinding, painful kind that burned her eyes, shining into the darkest recesses of her memory, leaving her nowhere to hide. She heard voices. Frank Hammond.
Someone framed Lenny and set you up to take the fall. Someone with inside information on Coram.
John Merrivale.
Trust Frank. Do everything he tells you and you'll be fine. Don't worry about the FBI. I'll deal with them.
The light faded. Warden McIntosh felt beads of sweat trickle down his back as he watched the flat green line on the heart monitor. Please, God, let her live. If Grace Brookstein succeeded in killing herself on his watch, his career would be over. He could wave goodbye to his pension, his retirement, to everything he'd worked so hard for these past 8 years. None of his achievements, his good intentions, would count for a damn. In that moment, James McIntosh hated Grace Brookstein more than he had ever hated another human being. The doctors applied shock paddles to Grace's heart. Her tiny body leaped off the bed. The green line flickered and then jumped to life, pulsing in a slow but steady rhythm. She's back. The head of the New York State Department of Corrections took the call at his golf club. I should be firing you, James. No questions asked. You do realize that?
Yes, sir.
If word got out, we'd allowed Grace Brookstein access to a sharp object in her own cell.
I know, sir. It won't happen again, sir.
Damn right it won't. And what was she doing on A-Wing in the first place? We sent her to Bedford Hills so she could be protected. Warden McIntosh fought down his irritation. Grace Brookstein didn't deserve to be protected. Even now that she was in jail, she was getting special treatment. It stuck in his craw. When she's well, I want her on 24-hour suicide watch. She gets psychotherapy, she gets decent food. What's her work detail? Warden McIntosh braced himself. She's been on the farm, sir. Early shifts. She's been what? Are you out of your fucking mind, James? I want her in the children's center with the nuns as soon as she's well enough. Capiche? Whatever you may feel about her personally, from now on I want you walking on eggshells with Lady Brookstein. Am I clear?
Yes, sir. Clear as crystal.
Grace woke up to a world of pain. It came in waves. The first wave was physical. The throbbing in her wrists, the parched dryness of her throat, the dull ache in her limbs. Whoever had inserted the needle in her arm had clearly done so in a hurry. Whichever way Grace turned, she felt a sharp stabbing in her vein. The entire surrounding area was badly bruised. The second wave was emotional. She tried to kill herself, and she had failed. She was not in heaven with her darling Lenny. She was here, in Bedford Hills, living the nightmare. Depression washed over her. But it was the third wave, the mental anguish, that made Grace sit bolt upright in bed and tear at her hair until the doctors came and sedated her. Somewhere, deep in her unconscious mind, between death and life, darkness and dawn, the truth had jumped out and grabbed her by the throat. In her mind, she heard Caroline Merrivale's voice, smug and spiteful. There will be no appeal. John wants nothing more to do with you. At the time, Grace had thought, no, not John. It's you. You're the one who wants nothing more to do with me. You've poisoned him. But now, finally, she realized. Caroline was just the messenger. It was John. It was John all along. John was the one who'd betrayed Lenny. He betrayed them both. The more Grace thought about it, the more obvious it was. John was the only person close enough to Lenny to have been able to steal that money. When the SEC started looking into Quorum, he must have panicked. Somehow, he persuaded Lenny to change the fund's partnership structure so that he, John, wouldn't be liable when the money was discovered missing. Of course, Lenny's sudden death must have raised the stakes dramatically. Exposure was always likely, but after Lenny disappeared, it became a certainty. Quorum investors started asking for their money back, and the fraud was exposed. But by then, it was easy for John to shift the blame to Grace. She was Lenny's partner now, not him. Better still, Grace trusted him. He made sure of that. When everyone else had deserted her, John Merrivale stayed close. Not because he cared for me, because he wanted to stage manage the whole thing. The FBI investigation, my trial. It was John who had dealt with the police, protecting Grace from their questions. It was John who had insisted she fire Kevin McGuire and hire Frank Hammond, the attorney who had let her down in court. Now that she was safely behind bars, John had washed his hands of her. He wasn't even man enough to come himself. He sent Caroline to do his dirty work for him. Looking back, Grace was astonished at her own naivety. The way she begged John to believe her about the partnership, to believe that she knew nothing about Lenny cutting him out and transferring his shares to her. How could I have been so stupid? It was in his interest not to be a partner. If John had been a partner, he'd have been legally liable for what had happened at Quorum. He'd be in jail now, not me. Grace had no idea how John had done it, how he'd managed to dupe Lenny into changing the company structure, never mind how he'd stolen all that money and kept it hidden. But she knew that he had done it somehow. If it took her the rest of her life, Grace Brookstein was going to find out how. I'll discover the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And when I do, I'll tell the world. I'll clear Lenny's name and my own. I'll get out of the hellhole. Grace slept. Gavin Williams felt dirty. Just being here inside a prison surrounded by deviants was enough to make his flesh creep. Of course, the fact that the wrongdoers were women made it all the more disgusting. It was unnatural. Women should be chaste and clean and subservient. They should be good and loving like his mother. Gavin Williams's mother had adored him. "You're so handsome, Gavin," she used to say. "You're so smart. You can be anything you want to be." Gavin bolted into the men's room and washed his hands for a third time, scalding them under the faucet until his skin was red raw. Women should be like his mother, but they weren't. In the real world, women were greedy, dirty bitches, whores who only wanted to have sex with you if you were rich or powerful. Hedge fund guys, billionaires like Lenny Brookstein, they spent their lives drowning in pussy. How Gavin Williams loathed those men with their flashy cars and their model girlfriends and their beach houses and their private jets. He, Gavin Williams, was better than the Lenny Brooksteins of this world. He was an incorruptible patriot, a modern-day Robespierre. He was a revolutionary bringing justice to America. "I am the righteous sword of the law. The Lord Almighty says, I will punish them. The young men will die, their sons and daughters starve. Not one of these plotters will survive, for I will bring disaster upon them." "Mr. Williams?" Gavin stood in the hallway of Bedford Hills Infirmary. A pretty young nurse looked at him strangely. "Yeah? What is it?"
"Mrs. Brookstein is awake. You can talk to her now."
Gavin Williams was certain that Grace Brookstein held the key to finding the stolen Quorum money. The rest of the FBI task force had given up on her as a potential witness. Harry Bain told him, "Forget about Grace, Gavin. She's a dead end. If she were going to tell us anything, she'd have done it by now." But Gavin could not forget about Grace. Her dirty whore's face haunted his dreams at night. Her voice mocked him during his long days spent poring over the complex paper trail that Lenny left behind. "I know," she taunted him. I know where that money is, and you don't. The press continually compared the Corum fraud with the Madoff case, but the two could not have been more different. Madoff's returns were so ludicrously consistent. It was plain to anyone with the brains to look that he was a fraud. Either he was doing insider trading or running a Ponzi scheme. Those were the only two logical possibilities. Given the fact that nobody traded with Madoff, none of the major banks, no brokerages, nobody, it had to be a Ponzi. Corum was different. Everybody had traded with Lenny Brookstein. There wasn't a firm on Wall Street that had seen through the guy, not a whisper of the scandal that was to engulf him and his fund so spectacularly. The missing Corum billions were not just the figment of some creative accountant's imagination. They were real. But Brookstein had been so secretive about his trades, even flying paper records to Cayman and Bermuda to be burned, it was virtually impossible to follow any transaction to its end point. Not unless you were an insider. Not unless you knew. When Gavin Williams got word of Grace Brookstein's suicide attempt, he knew it was an opportunity not to be missed. Like the last time he interviewed her at the morgue, she would be in a weakened state. But this time, there would be no lawyers to protect her, no phone calls, no escape. This time, Gavin Williams would squeeze her until she couldn't breathe. He would get the truth from Grace Brookstein if he had to make her vomit it out. For today's interview, Gavin had dressed as he always dressed. Dark suit and tie, his short, grey hair neatly parted, black shoes so shiny he could see his own reflection in the leather. Discipline. That was the key. Discipline and authority. Gavin Williams would make Grace Brookstein respect him. He would bend the deviant to his will and expose Harry Bain, his so-called boss, for the short-sighted fool that he was. When Grace saw Gavin Williams, her pupils dilated with fear. Gavin Williams smiled. Her terror aroused him.
Hello again, my dear.
She looked weak. Dwarfed by her white prison nightgown, still pale from blood loss, she seemed as insubstantial as a ghost or a wisp of smoke. What do you want?
I'm here to make a deal with you.
A deal?
Yes, a deal, you greedy bitch. Don't pretend you don't understand the concept. You're as corrupt as hell, and one day you will rot in hell for your sins.
It's a deal you can't refuse. The procedure is simple. You will provide me with 3 account numbers, all refer to funds held in Switzerland. You are familiar with all of them. Grace shook her head. She didn't know any account numbers. Hadn't they been through this the last time? In return, I will see to it that you are moved to a mental health facility.
Mental health? But I'm not crazy.
I assure you, the conditions at penal sanatoriums are considerably superior to those at correctional facilities such as this one. The account numbers, please. He handed Grace a piece of paper with a Credit Suisse letterhead. Grace glanced at it and sighed, closing her eyes. The drugs made her sleepy. As frightened as she was of this man, it was a struggle to stay awake.
John Merrivale, she croaked. It's John Merrivale. He took the money. He knows where it is. Ask him.
Gavin Williams' eyes narrowed. How typical of a woman to try to shift the blame just as Eve blamed the serpent when she polluted the world with her sin. How stupid did Grace think he was?
Did she think the FBI hadn't looked into Maryville, into all the staff at Quorum?
Don't play games with me, Miss Brookstein. I want those account numbers.
Grace was about to reason with him, but then she thought, what's the point? He won't listen. He's insane. If anyone needs a sanatorium, it's this guy, not me.
I know what you're doing. You're holding out for more.
Gavin Williams positively glowed with rage.
Well, you won't get it. Do you understand me? You won't get it.
Grace looked around for the nurse, but there was no one.
I'm all alone with this nutcase. There will be no appeal, no parole. It's the sanatorium or you will die in this place. Die. Give me those account numbers.
I told you. I don't know them.
Exhausted, Grace fell back on the pillow. She was losing the battle for consciousness. Sleep engulfed her. Gavin Williams watched her eyes flicker and close. Her neck is so tiny, so fragile, like a willow twig. I could reach out and snap it, just like that. Put my hands around her lying, thieving throat and crush the devil inside. There were no other patients. No staff. He and Grace were alone. No one would know. I could do it in a split second. Smite the wicked, purge the evil door of sin.
In a trance, Gavin Williams reached his hands out in front of him, flexing his long, bony fingers open and closed. Open and closed. He imagined Grace's windpipe collapsing beneath them, felt his excitement building.
I know what you're thinking.
The nurse's voice made him jump physically out of his seat.
Your fingers. I know what you're thinking.
Gavin was silent.
You're a smoker, aren't you? I was the same when I gave up. You never stop thinking about it, do you? Not for a second.
It took Gavin a moment to register what she was saying. She thinks I'm grasping for an imaginary cigarette. As if he, Gavin Williams, would ever be so weak as to succumb to an addiction. Out loud, he smiled and said,
No, you never do.
Believe me, I get it, chirped the nurse. It's like an itch you can't scratch. There's a courtyard outside if you're desperate.
Gavin Williams retrieved the Credit Suisse paper from Grace's sleeping fingers and slipped it back into his briefcase.
Thank you. I'm not desperate. But he was.
After 2 weeks, Grace returned to her cell on A-Wing. Warden McIntosh had intended to transfer her back to her original cell with the Latinas on the less austere C-Wing, but Grace became so agitated that the psychiatrists recommended the prisoner be allowed to have her way. The warden was baffled.
But Cora Buds assaulted her. She's one of our most violent inmates. I don't understand. Why would Grace want to go back to that?
The psychiatrist shrugged.
Familiarity?
Not for the first time, James McIntosh reflected on how little he understood the workings of the female mind. Grace's fellow inmates viewed the situation more crudely. No wonder Cora and Karen looked so excited. Did you hear? Grace is coming back to A-Wing. Looks like the oyster bar has reopened, ladies.
In fact, when the time came, Cora Buds greeted Grace coolly.
Something had changed about Grace. The old fear, the wariness had gone.
In its place was a calmness, a confidence that made Cora uneasy.
So, you made it, huh?
I made it.
Karen Willis was more demonstrative, flinging her arms around Grace and hugging her tightly. "Why didn't you talk to me? If things were that bad, you should have talked to me. I could have helped."
Karen Willis did not know what it was that drew her to Grace Brookstein. Part of it she put down to her stubborn streak. Grace was the underdog at Bedford Hills, a pariah, hated by screws and inmates alike. Karen Willis did not believe in running with the herd. Besides, Karen knew what it felt like to be an outsider, betrayed by one's own friends and family. When she shot her sister Lisa's abusive boyfriend, a bully and a rapist who had terrorized Lisa for 6 torturous years, Karen expected her family to rally around. Instead, they turned on her like a pack of hyenas. Lisa played the grief-stricken widow.
"We had our problems, but I loved Billy."
She even testified against Karen in court, making her out to be an angry, violent person who had a vendetta against men, implying that she acted not out of sisterly love, but out of sexual rejection. Karen always wanted Bill. I could see it. But Billy wasn't interested. The prosecutor changed the charges against Karen from manslaughter to second-degree murder. Karen never spoke to any of her family again. But Karen Willis's affection for Grace Brookstein ran deeper than their shared abandonment. Lisa had been right about one thing. Karen had never been much of a fan of men. Short, weasel-faced rapists like her brother-in-law Billy had never been Karen's type. Fragile, innocent blondes like Grace Brookstein, on the other hand, with her wide-set eyes and slender, supple gymnast limbs, her soft skin and smattering of girlish freckles across the nose, that was another matter entirely. Karen Willis was as far removed from the stereotypical predatory prison dyke as it was possible to get. Jokes about oyster bars made her want to gag. She had no intention of forcing herself on Grace. The girl was, quite clearly, A, straight, and B, grieving. Unfortunately, neither of those things changed the fact that Karen Willis was in love with her. When she heard Grace had tried to kill herself, Karen collapsed. When they told her Grace was going to live, that the worst was over, Karen wept with relief. Grace hugged her friend.
"You couldn't have helped, Karen. Not then, but perhaps you can help now."
"How? Tell me what you need, Grace. I'm here for you."
"I know who framed me and my husband. What I don't know is how he did it. I need evidence, proof, and I don't know where to begin."
A smile lit up on Karen's face. Perhaps she could help Grace after all.
"I have an idea."
Davy Bacola looked at his watch and stamped his feet against the cold. "I must be crazy coming out to this godforsaken place on some wild goose chase for Karen."
Davy Bacola was tall, dark, and, if not quite handsome, certainly better looking than the vast majority of his profession. He had olive skin, faintly scarred from acute teenage acne, intelligent hazel eyes, and strong, masculine features, dominated by an aquiline nose that gave him a hawk-like, predatory look. Women were attracted to Davy. At least, they were until he took them home to the shoddy 2-bedroom apartment in Tuckahoe he still shared with his mother, or picked them up in his 12-year-old Honda Accord, the same car he'd been driving when he graduated from high school. Private investigation was interesting work. Dangerous and challenging, but it didn't make anybody rich. It wasn't like Magnum P.I. Davy Bacola had had a crush on Karen Willis since they were kids. He felt bad when they locked her up and her family turned their backs on her. The shit for brains Karen killed had had it coming, but
Davy wasn't just here for Karen's sake. He was here for his own. He needed money, pure and simple, and Grace Brookstein had money. At last, the gates of the prison opened, and the visitors were taken through security. Davy Bucola had visited numerous correctional facilities, so he knew the drill. Coat off, shoes off, jewelry off, scanner, metal detector, dogs. Kind of like catching a plane, only without the luggage and the duty-free stores. Better for people watching, though. You could tell these moms right away. The tired slump of the shoulders, the resignation in the faces, aged from years of sacrifice and pain. There were a couple of husbands, deadbeats most of them. Overweight, long-haired, telltale signs of drug use. But overall, they were very few men in the visiting line. It was all women, women and children, braving the cold to make the depressing journey to Bedford Hills in hopes of keeping their families together. Davy thought, women are a lot less selfish than men. Then he thought, they're also a lot more conniving. Men lie when they have to. Women do it for kicks. He would listen to Grace Brookstein, but he would take nothing she said at face value. Davy walked into the visitor's room and sat down at a wooden table. A scrawny little kid came and sat down opposite him. I think you have the wrong seat. I'm here to meet Mrs. Brookstein. The kid smiled.
I'm Grace Brookstein. How do you do, Mr. Bucola?
Davy shook her hand and tried not to look shocked. I'm good, thanks.
Jesus H! What happened to her? She's only been in here a month.
The Grace Brookstein he'd expected to meet was the fur-clad vixen from the courtroom, glamorous, groomed, dripping in diamonds and disdain. The girl in front of him now looked about 14, with close-cropped hair and a pale urchin's face. She had a broken nose, deep shadows under the eyes, and she looked like she hadn't eaten in weeks. The orange jumpsuit she was wearing swamped her tiny frame. When Davy shook her hand, he noticed the skin was almost transparent.
Karen said you needed some help.
Grace dispensed with the pleasantries.
I want you to help me prove that John Merrivale framed me and my husband.
Karen hadn't mentioned anything about this.
She needs you to do a little digging.
Those had been her exact words. Nothing about Grace Brookstein being a total fucking Fruit Loop who convinced herself her old man was framed. Jesus. Every man and his dog knew that Lenny Brookstein was as crooked as a $2 bill.
John Merrivale. Wasn't he the number two at Quorum?
The guy the FBI has been working with? Reading his thoughts, Grace said,
I understand your skepticism. I don't expect you to believe me. All I'm asking is that you look into it. I'm doing as much research as I can from the library here, but I'm sure you appreciate my resources are limited.
Look, Mrs. Brookstein.
Grace.
Look, Grace, I'd like to help you, but I gotta be honest. The FBI has been through Quorum's finances with a fine-tooth comb. If there were any evidence that Merrivale had framed your husband, any evidence at all, don't you think they'd have found it?
Not necessarily. Not if they trusted him. John's been working with the FBI, Mr. Bucola. He's part of the investigative team. Don't you see? He's convinced them he's one of their own. Believe me, John Merrivale can be very plausible.
Plausible's one thing. Stealing $70 billion and stashing it where no one can find it, not the SEC, not the smartest brains at the Bureau, no one. Some might say that's impossible.
Grace smiled.
I believe that's what my attorney told the jury. And yet here I am.
Davy, because